I want to ask you a question. What do you think about during the Lord's Supper? What do you think about? Think about your child's behavior? Or maybe think about problems you're having at work? Or perhaps the prospects of your favorite football team? It's not football season yet, but that's how it goes. Or maybe it's the pot roast that's sitting at home and waiting for you, and the preacher's going to burn it if he preaches too long. What are you thinking about? Are you thinking about the death of Christ? Of all the rites ever observed, the Lord's Supper is the one with the deepest meaning. This is because of the one who instituted it. Many others are man-made and simply vain. But this is because of its simplicity, a unique supper. It requires no special religious language, no symbolism beyond the things that are within it. And there's nothing hidden or nothing shadowed about it. Everything about it is simple to understand. Why then do we have problems keeping our minds on the Lord during the most meaningful service? Perhaps it's because we don't plan to keep our mind on the Lord. That may be the reason. Or maybe it's because of the fact that we just don't have the mental discipline to do it. But this hour's lesson consists of one method by which we can keep our mind on the Lord when we are assembled around His table. Now let me say, this isn't original with me. I got it from another preacher who got it from some preacher that preached way back in 1800s, okay? But it is very beneficial, and the thoughts that are in it are good for us today, okay? So, let's launch out on this lesson. We want to remember these things during the Lord's Supper. We want to remember one Lord, two thieves, three crosses, four parts to His garments, five wounds, 6 hours of suffering, and seven sayings. Pretty simple, isn't it? Pretty simple. Well, let's talk about it. One Lord. He is the only one with authority in heaven and on earth. He declared it to His disciples. All authority has been given unto Me in heaven and on earth. This was the pretext that He used to send them out to preach the gospel throughout the world, because He had the authority to do it. He is the one that we must believe on. Except that you believe that I am, you shall die in your sins. John 8:24. He is the only way to the Father. No man comes unto Him except by Jesus, the way, the truth, and the life. That's it. There's no other way. And obviously, He's the one who died for us too. God demonstrates His own love towards us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Much more than having been justified by His blood, we shall be saved from wrath through Him. For if we were When we were His enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of His Son. Much more, having been reconciled, we shall be saved by His life. Romans 5:8-10. Another factor, we can only be saved in His name. There's no other name given among men by which you must be saved. It's not an option. And the last thing, the centurion was convinced. The centurion who stood there and watched and guarded Jesus saw the earthquake and the things that happened and feared greatly, saying, "This truly was the Son of God." But what about number two? Two thieves. Jesus was numbered with the transgressors. We notice in Isaiah 53 and 12 that the prophecy concerning him was, "Therefore I will divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul unto death, and he was numbered with the transgressors, bore the sins of many, and made intercession for the transgressors." Christ was convicted, although wrongfully, convicted and sentenced to death and counted as a criminal. In fact, you'll notice here in Matthew 26 and verse 66, "What do you think?" And they answered, "He is deserving of death." John 18:30, they asked him, "If he were not an evildoer, would we not have delivered him up to you?" Luke 23 and 33, "And when they had come to the place called Calvary, where they crucified him, and the criminals, one on the right hand and the other on the left." Though numbered with sinners, he himself was without sin. Notice this, Hebrews 4 and 15, "We do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weakness, but in all points was tempted as we are tempted, yet without sin." Without any sin, period. And of course, Peter, in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 22 says, "Who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth." We find a sinless one right here in the presence of two thieves. What else do we find? Well, we find out there's three crosses. There's three crosses. Do you realize there is more in the Old Testament about the crucifixion than there is in the New? Did you ever stop to think about that? I'm going to just kind of hurriedly run through some of this, but I want it to impress you. Psalm 22, verses 1 through 18. "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me and from the words of my groaning?" Verse 8. "He trusted in the Lord. Let him rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. The congregation of the wicked has enclosed me. They pierce my hands and my feet." Verse 17, "I can count all my bones. They look at me and they stare at me. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots." Then in Zechariah 12 and 10, "I will pour on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication. Then they will look on me whom they pierced. Yes, they will mourn for him as one mourns for his only son, and grieve for him as one grieves for a firstborn." Isaiah 53, verses 4 and 5. "Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him as stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed." That's just a sample. Just a sample. But all these things that are contained over here in the Old Testament are descriptive of what happened on Calvary. That's what happened. So the three crosses up there is significant to us. It makes some difference. Makes a difference to us. But we want to go on and look at the fourth. The four parts to his garment. As a convicted criminal, his garments belong to his executioners. That's the way it was. Whatever clothing he had on him was the property of the executioners. Notice Psalm 22 and verse 18. They divide my garments among them, for my clothing they cast lots. This was humiliating, and that was part of the reason why it was that way. It was humiliating to him to have to give up his clothes. But you know, Jesus humbled himself. We notice in Philippians chapter 2, verses 6 through 8, he humbled, who, being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant, and coming in the likeness of men, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross. Jesus came from this high place down to earth for the purpose, for no other purpose, than to die and to make salvation possible for you and me. That's pretty amazing, isn't it? Pretty amazing. But we have five wounds to look at. The wounds were proof to Thomas whenever he was resurrected. Notice in John 20, verses 25 through 28, the other disciples said to him, "We have seen the Lord." That is, they were talking to Thomas, and they said, "We have seen the Lord." So he said unto them, "Unless I see his hands and the print of the nails, and put my finger into the prints of the nails, and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." And after 8 days, his disciples were again inside, and Thomas with them. And Jesus came, the doors being shut, and stood in the midst of them. And he said, "Peace to you." Then he said to Thomas, "Reach your finger here, and look at my hands. Reach your hand here, and put it into my side. Do not be unbelieving, but believing." And Thomas answered and said to him, "My Lord and my God." Literally translated, "The Lord of me and the God of me." Isn't that something? We know that these wounds were significant because we're told back in Isaiah that he was wounded for our transgressions. But he wasn't just bushwhacked. He wasn't slightly injured in the process. He was killed in the process. And in fact, we read that while he hung on the cross, that one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately came blood and water rushing out of it. But you know, Jesus had prophesied this himself. You know that? He said in Matthew 26 and 28, when he was instituting the Lord's Supper with his disciples, "For this is the blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of sins." It was not an accident that he shed his blood. It was by divine providence that he shed his blood. God's plan, shed blood. And Jesus did it. But, you know, we ought to be thankful for it, because over here in Romans 9, we're told that we're justified by his blood. If he hadn't have shed his blood, we wouldn't be justified. We wouldn't be saved from wrath through him. And further, we would not have forgiveness of sins. Look at Ephesians 1 and verse 7. In him we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of sins, according to the riches of his grace. That's pretty important. It's pretty important. And another point, and this is, I don't know if you've thought about this. In 1 Corinthians 10 and 16, Paul says, the cup of blessing which we bless, is it not the communion of the blood of Christ? And the bread which we break, is it not the communion of the body of Christ? Communion calls for joint participation. And not always is it a participation that requires all persons to be doing the same thing at the same time. In this case, and I want you to read the context of this because it talks about the altar and the sacrifices that are laid upon it and so forth. In this case, it's talking about the body that was given for us and the blood that was given for us and us being partakers of it. That's the communion we have of the body and the blood. That's pretty important, isn't it? A very important point to remember indeed. But then we come down here to 6 hours of suffering. 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. approximately. That's a long time. It's a long time to be sitting in a doctor's office or an urgent care emergency room or something. It's a long time. But imagine hanging on a cross, both of your hands nailed to the cross beam, your feet nailed to the upright, 9 to 3 o'clock p.m. And most of all, the thing that makes it most significant is it was totally voluntary. It was totally voluntary. We turn to Matthew 26 and verse 53. Jesus says, Do you think that I cannot now pray to my Father and he will provide me with more than 12 legions of angels? We sang the hymn just before this, 10,000 angels. And there's so many things in that song that relate to this lesson, by the way. I could just about preach the song. But Jesus hung on the cross in a helpless state with the power to do something about it. Think about that. He merely had to call and he would have 12,000 angels at his disposal. But instead, Jesus said, Father, if it is your will that this cup, take this cup away from me, nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. What does that say? He was willing to let his will be the Father's will. That's what he says. Jesus was willing to give his life for you and for me. What a picture. What a scene. But then we hear him saying seven things. Now, the things that he said are, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. This is the Lord. They have just wronged him terribly, nailed him to a cross. And the first thing he says, Father, forgive him. He knew that these people who were putting him to death had no earthly idea of the significance. And he asked his Father to forgive him. What a scene. What a beautiful picture is painted for us here. And then he says, assuredly, I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. Now, what's that all about? Well, you remember one of the thieves had said to him, well, he chastised the other thief, and then he said to Jesus, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Jesus said, this day you will be with me in paradise. What thoughts must have gone through that man's head when the Lord said that? Here I am, a convicted thief, and I know I'm guilty. You know, I'm being put to death because of my guilt. And Jesus, this innocent one over here who's being crucified, he says, today you'll be with me in paradise. What visions must have come to his mind? You know what? The word paradise describes a beautiful garden. It was very often that royalty had a beautiful, beautiful garden. And they would go, the royal people would walk in the evening in it, in the cool of the evening. But he said, today you'll be with me in paradise. Now, we know that to be the place that's also described in Luke's account of the rich man Lazarus. We know that that's described as Abraham's bosom. But what he was saying to him was, you're going to have a big change pretty quick. Right now, you're suffering. You're up here. I'm right alongside of you, suffering. And you know what? You're going to have a change. Today, you'll be with me in paradise. But then, Jesus turned. And I want you to know that this is a key point. He's mindful of his mother. Now, we don't know what the circumstances are here. We surmise that Joseph may be deceased, possibly, and that she may be a widow. Now, the reason for that is that he says to her, behold thy son. Behold thy son. Well, what was he talking about? John was who he was talking about, and the disciple whom he loved. John was who he was talking about, and it says, from that hour that disciple took her to his own home. Why would she go to his house if Joseph was still alive? Doesn't make sense. But regardless, he took thought for his physical relationship that he had with his mother and showed love for her. And then he said something that didn't sound exactly right. He didn't speak in English. He cried out, Eli, Eli, sabachthani. What in the world was that? Well, thankfully, the text tells us what it means. my God, why have you forsaken me? It is found in the Old Testament. We just read it a couple of minutes ago. The Old Testament prophecy of what he would say. My God, why have you forsaken me? Truly, you can imagine Jesus struggling with the physical aspects of this crucifixion. While indeed he could call 10,000 angels, he didn't. He suffered death, and notice we talked about him humbling himself unto death, even the death on the cross. He suffered death on the cross just like any man would. Just like any man would. And it was taking so long. How long? Think about it. Think about the hours. Man, 9:03. This is crazy. But all he could ask was, why have you forsaken me? It's over. I want to get it over with. But after this, he said immediately, number 5, I thirst. After this, Jesus, knowing all things were now accomplished, that the scripture might be fulfilled, he said, I thirst. He yielded to the physical desire to have some relief. And he said, I thirst. But you know, God being merciful as he is, we find Jesus saying, it is finished. It is finished. What is it that was finished? What was finished? We sang it in the hymn. The sinful work of man was done. And the work of that brought salvation is completed. Right there. It is finished. So when he had received the sour wine, he said, it is finished, bowing his head. He gave up his spirit. But that's only 6 sayings. And I promised you 7. The 7th one is, Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. This is Luke's account. The other is John's account. And I think they're both significant. He cried to the Father with a loud voice and said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And having said this, he breathed his last. 7 sayings of Jesus, all significant and all worthy of our consideration. But, I have to ask you again, what do you think about during the Lord's Supper? What do you think about during the Lord's Supper? Are you distracted by the things around you? Do you look at something like a book, or maybe look at your phone, look, see what time it is, make sure you're on time? You worry about other things? Or do you simply concentrate on the Lord and the sacrifice which he gave for you? Let me put it this way. If someone were to run into a burning house and save the life of my family, I sure wouldn't be ignoring or mistreating them. I would be thanking them and thanking them and showing them the respect, all the respect that I could for the wonderful thing that they did for me. But you know, Jesus walked into death for us. And he took it without any question, because he knew the only way man could have salvation was for him to die. What do you think about during the Lord's Supper? I dare say that each one of us has something that we can do, something we can work on to be more properly in the mind and in the spirit that is necessary to partake of the Lord's Supper. Every one of us can do that. Whether you think about the Lord or think about his sacrifice, whatever you think about, make sure it's pertaining to his supper. Don't let any other distractions, whatever they are, take your mind away from that. Someone said to me, you should preach that Sunday morning and have the Lord's Supper afterwards. Yeah, that's right. But I'm preaching it now. And Lord willing, the next time that we observe the Lord's Supper together, all of us will be able to be prepared and to observe it as good as we possibly can. As good as we possibly can.